Yeah, they still own the oil companies. It's not just the subsidies, but many governments own the actual companies.
Yes, we're talking about Saudi Arabia and Iran and Norway, but, you know, Canada and Australia and the United States are major fossil fuel producers, and it's a very complicated subject.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. We are chewing our way through big news in climate science and extreme disasters unfolding around the world. Last week, I spoke with journalist and author Gwen Dyer about Earth intervention. And I remember talking with you, Paul, years ago when you were ready to try spraying sulfates over the Arctic, trying to save the sea ice. Do you think we need geoengineering now to save a livable climate?
Yes, and the Exeter article kind of skirts around, you know, one aspect of geoengineering, so-called geoengineering. I mean, we need to really separate it. The governments around the world are fully pushing for carbon dioxide removal or carbon removal from the atmosphere. So, you know, whenever they talk about net zero, they're talking about the carbon that goes up into the atmosphere minus the carbon that's removed from the atmosphere, and they have fantasies or hopes, or they assume that we'll have technologies that can take vast amounts of CO2 and methane out of the atmosphere, you know, at some point within the next couple of decades. So whenever they talk about net zero, this is what they're implying, so carbon removal from the atmosphere without actually saying it. Right, so that's half of the geoengineering coin, if you like. And then, of course, the other half is to block some sunlight so that the planet doesn't heat up and we don't, you know, lose the threat on the planet, basically. And, you know, that's called SRM, which sounds like an accountant came up with that name, solar radiation management. And I much prefer the term SOS, which stands for not just save our souls, but solar optimization systems or solar optimizing strategies. And these ideas include things like iron fertilization of the ocean to stimulate phytoplankton blooms to capture more carbon, solar aerosol injection. I think SAI is the acronym often used, which is the idea of you can actually create, by injecting sulfur into the stratosphere, you can block sunlight and cool the planet by a known amount, depending on how much you put up into the atmosphere. And it also, the sulfur, as I mentioned, acts as cloud condensation nuclei, generating, you can generate low-level clouds, which can cool the planet. So I think, as it is, I can almost guarantee you that we will be doing this probably fairly soon, especially if the acceleration of the warming continues as it has been since 2010. So, you know, like it or not, it's going to come to our planet. I would be willing to bet a lot that's going to happen. So Gwen Dyer talks about the different methods that people have been thinking about, and he actually has his new book, Intervention, fortunate enough to actually meet him just a few weeks ago, because he came to the Ottawa International Book Festival and spoke about his book. And also Michael Mann has a book out, which, so he was also at the Writers Festival. So it was good to sort of see their different viewpoints.
Almost every week, scary new science reveals even more ways ice at both poles is under attack as the world warms. You've been specializing in this for decades. In February, you posted a video about the global reach of atmospheric rivers. So we hear about atmospheric rivers hitting the West Coast, like California or even Vancouver, but all the way to the poles?
Yes. You know, again, it comes back to the waviness of the jet streams. If there's a large temperature contrast between the poles and the equator, then the jet streams actually move fairly quickly, and they stay relatively straight. You know, they're not completely straight, but they circumvent these in the jet stream behavior, in the jet stream patterns. But, of course, with the greatly warming Arctic and the slowing and increased waviness in the north-south, then, you know, the jet streams can become extremely, extremely wavy, you know, and the troughs of the waves can actually end up close to the equator at times, and the crest of these waves can extend up into the high Arctic. So the atmospheric rivers just kind of follow the path of these huge waves in the jet stream, and they can bring lots of moisture and warmth, for example, up into the Arctic at times. You know, and when that happens, of course, it tends to equalize temperatures with latitude. So, you know, a jet stream that's extending far south and extending far north, almost up to the North Pole, brings warm air to the north, and it brings cold air to the south, so it tends to try to equalize temperature with latitude. But then also there's the AMOC wild card, right? Because if the AMOC actually shuts off, the Arctic will get very cold again. And in fact, Western Europe will drop temperatures significantly. Parts of Norway, northern Scandinavia, will be extremely cold. Mean average temperature is much, much lower than now. And during winters, the sea ice could extend all the way across the Arctic, almost over to northern Europe, if the AMOC shuts off. So we've got that wild card.
Just a point, though, about the global reach of atmospheric rivers. When they get to the poles, two things. First of all, we started getting reports just a few years ago from scientists in research stations way up high on the ice in Greenland saying, hey, it's raining here. It's raining all across Greenland, and that never happens this time of year. And second, the impact on the winter formation of sea ice. Tell us about that.
Yeah, exactly. So we get all of these type of effects, and I mean, of course, you know, the rain is devastating. You know, the warm water flows across the ice, causing tremendously rapid melt. It gets rid of the fresh snow layers, which are very highly reflective, right? Very, very white, very high albedo, reflecting sunlight, keeping the Arctic colder, of course, when the sun is out. So this is in Arctic summers. But it also exposes the debris and dirt and material, you know, ash, whatever, that's sitting on top of that's within the ice. So, you know, it lowers the albedo that way as well. And, of course, it ensures that any sea ice that does form is actually very thin and then can melt out that much quicker in the summer. So all of these sort of effects are kind of feeding into each other. Yeah, we've had these atmospheric rivers bring temperatures to the North Pole well above zero in the middle of winter, for example, and the rain instead of snow. So it just changes everything. And then, of course, you've had to deal with them. You know, California's had to deal with the atmospheric rivers. And there was a period in the, 1860s or something when, you know, it basically rained for an entire month or more in California, and we got an inland lake forming in the Central Valley of California, which puts Sacramento 15 feet underwater, right? And then it took a year for that lake to evaporate out, more than a year. So that was atmospheric river based. So, you know, they've been around for a long time. Again, that's probably a fairly new term for people. You know, we didn't have that. Most people, you could have asked them a decade ago, what's an atmospheric river? They'd look at you with a blank stare, but the derecho and atmospheric river, all these different terms are haboobs, you know, dust storms, all of these different terms to describe weather events that were very rare before are becoming in the sort of general vernacular because they're happening more and more frequently.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. We're talking about the world. So these big changes on the planet are coming just too fast, and there's too many of them for our small brains to comprehend. We have specialists who find that bugs, bats, or frogs are disappearing, and forest experts worry the Amazon will not recover, changing rainfall across the world. We've got permafrost scientists getting hoarse, happening there. Ice people are alarmed. Do you have advice on how to cope with the fire hose of news about our shifting environment?
Well, I guess it's important for us to for our sort of emotional stability, to have outlets for sure, so we can kind of, you know, have hobbies or outlets or other things that we're passionate about to kind of distract us. But the idea of agency, I think, is very important. One of the worst feelings that any person can have is this feeling of helplessness, right? Like, well, I can't do anything. So, you know, it leads to sort of lethargy and interferes with functioning of your day-to-day life, right? So it's important to have some sort of sense of agency. So, you know, we all have different backgrounds, different training, different skill sets. So I think one of the keys is to figure out, okay, we're worried about the climate crisis. We'd like to make some sort of impact, even, you know, the very smallest impact, or at least feel we're doing something. So how can we apply our skill set, you know, which is different for every person, to doing something, you know, maybe going to joining your local climate activist group, going on a march protest or something, or, you know, starting a blog, or just sending, if you know, decision makers, if you know, politicians, somebody that you have, you're friends with or have some influence over, to get them more up to speed on the climate emergency, right? There's sort of many different things that we can. I think when we do these things, we shouldn't focus on results at all. I think we just do it because it's the right thing to do, and it does make us feel a bit more empowered. You know, whether or not it has any impact is, you know, that's something that we don't have so much control over, right?
I talk with scientists, of course, and you do, and we have charts and we have numbers, but we know the majority of people now sweating out the heat from fossil-powered society do not live in it. A recent guest talked about the millions of families in India living in rude houses with metal roofs. One study showed temperatures inside such shack houses can go up to 140 degrees Fahrenheit or 60 Celsius. So there's no shelter inside, there's no shelter outside, and for millions they've got no electricity or air conditioning either. I don't know how they stand it or what they think about it or how they will react as this goes on. Would you talk to us about your April video on the, quote, impacts of Earth tipping points on societal breakdown, radicalization, polarization, enemy, and wars? And you would have to define what enemy means and what that has to do with climate change. What was that video about, Paul?
Basically, this is a year, 2024, when we have lots of elections around the world. And what we're seeing sort of politically is we seem to be getting a tilt to more extreme right political leaders around the world and more extreme right points of view. Just look at Santos in Florida, I mean, trying to ban the concept of climate change. Well, climate change is not happening in Florida because I'm legislating that it doesn't happen in Florida. I mean, things like this, like, it's just like you kind of roll your eyes and say, well, you know, our society is going absolutely crazy. The idea, a lot of it comes to the position of people, you know, is a key one, right? Because, you know, as things get worse, or as people's perception of global stability, globalness worsens, and you think, you know, the world is becoming a lot more of a dangerous place, and countries sort of turn more inward, and they, you know, they become more pushed, you know, against immigration, for example, against, you know, letting people in from other places, and countries become more protectionist, and you know, so things tend to tilt more to you know, right wing governments and right wing policies. You know, I think climate is behind a lot of these changes. We know how climate can enable or increase the likelihood of scramble for resources, for fresh water, for food, you know, and those sort of things can lead to wars and conflicts. And, you know, I think the Syrian example is very good because we had, you know, record, you know, 1-in-1,000-year droughts for many years in a row in Syria, so people could no longer grow food. So farmers moved to the cities, no jobs, and, you know, political unrest and civil war. So climate droughts and famines and things can really, you know, trigger these sort of much wider geopolitical conflicts.
Well, it's not very radical to say that humans are shaped by their environment and the environment is changing. So there you go. The thing strange I find is that the people most vocal about climate danger are either young or old. The climate activism is bubbling on campus. Young people do know, yet social media is filled with older activists, well, like you and certainly me. And the working generation in between seems trapped in debt, working for some corporation, keeping pretty quiet, hoping the whole thing doesn't collapse soon. And they stick to cars and diesel trucks even when their homes burn down or flood or blow away. It just makes you wonder, what will it take to get the average person into this battle, into the streets, into the voting booths, demanding emergency climate action? Do you know?
Well, I don't think we'll have to wait very long. You know, I think the disruptions that we're seeing and the acceleration of the global warming and the increases of extreme weather events and more climate catastrophes around the world, you know, I think it's going to hit, the weakness for human society, which is our global food supply, really, food and water supply. And, yeah, we're going to probably have jet stream configurations in the not-too-distant future where we get multiple failures in breadbaskets around in the Northern Hemisphere. So, you know, we greatly lose the ability to grow sufficient food to feed the planet for several years. And at least there is some sort of buffer because we waste, 30 to 40% of everything that we produce right now. And so if we have a shortfall of growing 30 to 40% of wheats and corns and whatever, you know, our basic, we'll be happy that buffer is there because, you know, nobody will waste food. Prices will become so high. So I think that sort of thing is going to be happening in the next 5 to 10 years, I would estimate, be my best guess. It's sooner than people think. And then we don't have any choice.
On the brighter side, we could experience a flowering of human knowledge and abilities unique in the history of our species. I mean, disease and aging are being approached. Maybe we'll make big progress there. And new technology makes leaps in artificial intelligence. Sure, it could kill us, but it could also make lives better for billions of people if it goes right. Maybe AI will connect and direct the carbon reduction economy. Are you open, Paul, to the possibilities of the good as well as the evil in these times?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, part of human nature, you know, part of, we were talking about how you stay sort of sane emotionally and, in light of what's happening. And I think part of the human condition is to have hope that it's darkest just before the dawn sort of thing. So AI, yeah, I mean, I always kind of joke that, okay, so you get the best, we develop AI, you know, super intelligence and far outperforming, you know, human intelligence, and we put it in control of a lot of things, and we say to AI, okay, solve climate change. You know, my concern is it says basically get rid of the humans, right? So... But it's hard to predict the future, right?
It may go better than we think, though, as well as worse than we think at the same time. So as an expert with 2 master's degrees and years of experience, you're a real digger and researcher. You make peanuts in donations, I'll bet, teaching the world for free. Paul, why do you do this?
I guess it's habit at this point. You know, it keeps me out of trouble. I mean, it's, you know, always trying to come up with some new idea or new way of communicating, you know, getting message out. And, it's like a chess puzzle. I love to play games like chess and bridge and backgammon and poker, you know, just with friends, not for cash. But, you know, it's sort of like a big puzzle. You know, how do we get out of this big hole that we've dug ourselves into? So, you know, you reach a point where you just keep going, right?
It is the biggest story never told. We're going to have to wrap it up, Paul. From Ottawa, Canada, we've been speaking with climate scientist and system scientist Paul Beckwith. And Paul has dedicated his life to educating the public on climate science. His main tools are hundreds of free videos on his YouTube channel. And he finds and interprets key breaking science for the rest of us. Paul, tell us some of the media places that people can find you.
mostly, you know, just search for my name on YouTube. You know, if you just Google Paul Beckwith climate change, you can find all kinds of articles and things I've written in the past. But mostly it's through social media, on videos and on my blog and so on. So I also do work with Climate Emergency Forum, which is just basically a group of friends who, you know, we do a weekly video. We interview different people or just talk amongst ourselves. And also I do some work with another group called Facing Future, which is a video every few weeks or so on all of these topics. So it's pretty easy, I think, to find me on the web.
Okay, listeners, check out paulbeckwith.net as well, and I'll put links to everything that we've talked about here, every video and every paper we just talked about.
I mean, I'm fortunate that my name is not John Brown or Alex Smith.
Alex Smith, right? Yeah. If you Google Alex Smith, you get a football player, I think.
So I'm fortunate. So maybe you should consider changing your name if you want to get more widespread coverage, Alex.
Yeah. Thanks for talking with us, Paul.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. A feature on American News: breathless reporters announcing new records for driving and flights on the holiday weekend. 3 million people a day pass through the airports, while 38 million folks drive at least 50 miles from home. Will it be a new record? Higher than 2005? How exciting! What a great sign! The economy has recovered. Americans are confident. They have no clue. Sadly, extreme weather is causing flight cancellations and some rerouting. Should I do a special on how extreme weather is threatening the airline industry? We could get experts on. This shows how upside down our view of reality is, the extreme danger of unreality. The real story: record air travel will certainly help create not just more extreme weather, but uninhabitable and starving areas around the world. As CNN frantically described the record numbers of travelers on the road, almost 40 million Americans, they compared gas prices, talked with folks in traffic jams, and advised driving early in the morning or late at night to avoid those clogged roads. In a sign from the universe, the headline crawl below said, 6 killed in northwest India in the heat. Temperatures rise up to 122 degrees, and heat expected to last another 5 days. Perfect disconnect. Not a clue. The two stories are directly connected. We are driving poorer people into climate chaos for a holiday.
All right, bravo. One more car destroyed.
There is your tableau on live TV. Record holiday travelers, heat deaths overseas. NOAA predicts a terrible hurricane season due to the hot Atlantic. Killer tornadoes cluster in the Midwest. Straight-line winds blow out downtown towers in Houston and wind turbines. Hail on the gardens and crops. Smoke from northern forests infesting American cities from thousands of miles away. We are in the climate emergency right now, and we still don't know it. The pot is boiling, and none of us frogs feel like jumping out. Perhaps we can withdraw from this travel addiction gently, while community resources and moving family members closer together can happen. So, I propose just 2 flights per year per person. Anyone taking more than 2 flights a year receives significant penalties with community service times for repeat offenders. Exceptions would be made for essential services like an air ambulance flight crew. No exceptions for wealth. No private jets at all. Stop flying. We are wrecking the earth. Concurrent with stringent flying limits, corporations need to institute online meetings instead of travel immediately, as they did during the beginning of the COVID pandemic. Companies, not individuals, need to be given strict goals to reduce commuting and enable online work from home or local walkable, bikeable work centers. Stop burning fossil fuels to get to work. Individual cars need to become quickly a thing of the past. Shared cars and community trucks are the mid-step towards ending combustion engine transport completely. Production of combustion engines for vehicles needs to stop this year. We have billions of those motors, and each one commits to another decade or two of fossil fuel burning, which is not possible if we want a habitable world. End combustion engine production, electric engines only. The world needs to slash fossil fuel production by burning at least 10% a year less every year, starting with the countries with the highest per capita use and historic burden of carbon. And I'm sorry, but that's us. That's you, the listeners, and me. So all the developed countries go first, and they hit the hardest in reductions. If we do not cut by 10% a year, it looks like Earth will become at least 3 degrees Celsius hotter around 2100 and keep getting hotter after that. The tragic new realities at that level of warming are difficult to imagine, but it does include super cities on the coasts abandoned to the sea, along with agricultural deltas feeding hundreds of millions. It includes mass migration. It includes the limits of human survival on this planet. It includes massive floods and wildfires and the spread of tropical disease. It includes a string of societal collapses and likely civil wars or maybe gang rule. It includes a broken future where population reduction is forced by nature. That all sounds worth it, doesn't it? Chances are millions of you will soon be living in the emergency anyway, in a fossil-powered world. You may be on the wildfire alert or forced to evacuate. You may be getting out of floods or having homes torn apart by super hurricanes. Your power will go out as heat overloads the electric system. Your kids will have to stay home from school. You may have to huddle inside your home, assuming you still have one. Make sure there's room there for a few climate refugees. This is the luxurious life we pretend to conserve as we keep on polluting as normal. If you are thinking slashing reductions requires a dictatorship or nobody's going to do that, it's never going to happen, then you agree this civilization will continue until it reaches an extinction point with generations of suffering along the way. Sign on the dotted line. You agree to damage the future to continue your present. Tell your kids and grandkids about your decision to wreck the future. Pin that declaration on your social media page and post it with your photo on a placard outside your house. I want to wreck the future. You will enter the infamous record of climate criminals, and that is your legacy. If you really don't care, if you really want to inflict suffering and death on millions of people while you make a few bucks more, be upfront about it. Tell it like you are. Harsh truths for harsh times. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get out of this climate crisis. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to the future. To get you started, appetizers are on fire. Wash that down with you. Rain tonight, the main course is hot, very hot. We have fried bees and dead fruit trees. We have displaced people huddled on the sand. We have the last deluxe tables on the damaged land. You have artificial views, and the ocean comes to you. You get mental storms and broken norms to enrich the chosen few. Welcome to the future, where everything is new. Sorry to bother you, but now your children have to pay. All children have to pay starting today. Sorry to disturb you, but we are closing soon. We are closing soon. soon.